Did you hear Jeff Bezos shot Captain Kirk in outer space this past week? That's right. Captain Kirk went up for 5 minutes, went up and down, did not orbit, but he got his astronaut wings. In that short 5-minute journey, he managed to start 3 wars and interfere with the development of 5 civilizations. So I'm thinking it was a pretty good deal since it used to take him about an hour to do all that. Hey, howdy, howdy, ho. It's Daniel Markham here. I'm glad to see you. You're here with Nerd Roundup. And Nerd Roundup, if you haven't been here before, oh, by the way, some of the crew were actually unhappy with the uniforms they had this past week's launch. They thought maybe the color coordination wasn't exactly right. If you guys don't know, in Star Trek, if you wear the red uniform, you automatically die in the episode. So, yeah, I'm telling Trek jokes to people who don't watch a lot of Trek. Anyway, Nerd Roundup is a place where we come by once a week, look at the week's technical articles, tell jokes, goof off. I firmly believe, that teams that can relax and talk about anything in a good-natured spirit can accomplish anything. And so it's really important to exercise those muscles, and I haven't found any way to show people how to do this except for just doing it. You can tell people, like, here's how you're nice to people, but it's just better just to do it. So this week we have James Grinning, and we also have Greg Young coming and going. James, howdy-ho. I got to put my hat on, dang.
Dan. Hey, you know, so one other thing about the space trip with the captain, he also got the girl after the flight. You notice, did you watch the the post-landing thing?
I wanted to tell a joke like that. I was like, no, I just don't think Twitter can handle anything involving, like, 60s sexuality would not work too well.
Oh, come on.
Trigger words, dude. But, you know, they had some gorgeous actress just barely wearing anything in that show. And as I understand, they all enjoyed themselves except for Terry Garr, who appeared on one show, and she swore she would never, ever go back on a Star Trek after that. And she wouldn't say what it was. She just, like, I'm never, ever doing it again. Whatever happened to her was a bad thing. So, James, what have you been up to this week?
Well, this week I had 12 embedded engineers over near Oslo learning about test-driven development. So I had to get up early every day. It's nice to take a break and hang out with my friend. How about you, Dan? What'd you do this week?
I have spent 4 different tries with Amazon to get a cord to power my miner here, Bitcoin miner. 4th try was successful. I have what I need is a plug that goes into my dryer plug, 220 volts, and then on the other side has a sort of a Chinese adapter thing. It was a struggle. And then I also built my book. You build books now because you compile them. So I've got the first section, about 100 pages done so far. That was kind of cool. And then a bunch of other stuff. Greg.
Sorry about that.
No problem. What you been up to this week? Yeah, howdy.
I had a Windows Update reboot.
Because, of course. You know, when I do this, I go through a checklist. I got up this morning, I did there's a huge Windows update. I guess you just found that out. And even then, something always happens I don't anticipate. Greg, what have you been doing this past week?
Oh, a lot of unimportant things.
But they'll become important housekeeping things, right?
I have spent at least a full day trying to deal with getting a new passport.
Oh, wow.
So I'm supposed to be flying out in about a week. And my passport is, like, expired, but it's expired by, like, a week or two.
Ah, dang.
So how do you get a new passport within that period of time? So it looks like I'm going to be going on a trip to New York to get a new passport.
Yeah, you got to start over, and can't you do the $85 rush thing?
I've tried varying things. I've even ordered through an agency and already paid for it, but haven't received it from that agency.
Oh, wow.
It's been interesting, to say the least.
God dang. I'm sorry.
So you don't have a supply chain with your money. You have a supply chain problem. A supply chain problem with the money you're paying them, but they've got a supply chain problem getting you your product, huh?
Something like that. Yeah. But even more annoyingly is, so it's like I found out a solution to it, which is I am going to go get on a train. I'm going to go to New York City. and go to the physical office.
Cool.
But then they're telling me that depending on the day, they may or may not be able to actually get me my passport.
My wife had to do some business with the Social Security office. She had to download an app. If you want to go to the office, you have to have an app first. The app tells you if you go in the building. You just wait, look at your phone until I guess it turns green or something.
Where are you going to go, Greg?
You mean for my trip?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm heading over to Europe.
Oh, cool.
They're going to let you in?
I shouldn't have any problem with that.
Are you dual nationality?
No, I am a resident, but I'm not a citizen.
Okay. Well, cool.
What the American equivalent would be, it would be like maybe having a green card versus being a citizen.
Oh, yeah. I did the same thing with Canada. There's like a work permit or something.
Yeah. So I shouldn't run into any problems like crossing a border or anything like that.
I didn't know about the COVID thing, if they were, what the rules were on that.
Yeah.
They vary heavily from place to place.
And hopefully the rules don't change enough so that you get to come home.
Yeah, a lot of people got trapped. So did you guys watch William Shatner go up in the penis mobile into space?
But you didn't want this to be sexual, Daniel.
No, I'm just saying it. Okay, it was. Is it the New Glenn or the New Shepherd? I forget the name.
It's New Shepherd.
Okay. It's easy to remember the other name, but New Shepherd's tougher. Okay, I'll see if I can start using that. Did you guys watch it?
I watched some of it.
I watched a video of it afterwards.
Yeah.
Yes. I was watching a little bit during. I got to put my Blue Origin hat on for this
conversation.
Oh,
cool. Very cool.
And I've got my Blue Origin shirt on, too. And so you know the significance of the name of the mission?
No, I do not.
So basically, when you and I were kids, all three of us were kids, you know, they were blasting people up into space, and Shepard was the first guy to go. He didn't go into orbit. He just went on a big parabolic run, which is basically what the New Shepard project is about replicating that.
Okay.
And making that, I mean, aside from that, the booster comes and lands like 2 miles from where it took off.
I'm thinking that Elon Musk should shoot up Captain Picard now so we could just kind of get this party started.
Get all the captains out of the way. Yeah.
Have a big captain rocket battle. Yeah. Shatner said, he's like the oldest guy ever to go into 90 years old.
That's pretty cool.
Oldest guy, first TV movie actor, I think, that was shot into space. Some neat stuff. The thing I was most impressed by was the difference between Shatner, the public dude, Captain Kirk, whatever, and like this 90-year-old guy getting off a rocket going, oh my God, this was freaking amazing. It's like, okay, now I've actually met the guy. All these years I've seen him on TV, now I kind of know him, right?
Yeah. Did you look at the capsule, you know, in the background?
Yeah.
See how big the windows are?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did some work with Blue Origin a couple of years ago, and one of the teams, I think they're responsible for some flight control or some launch control or something like that. And I got this amazing tour, and one of the things I got to do is sit in the mock-up of the New Shepard capsule, and it's really cool. Everybody gets a window and an aisle. There's six giant windows. You saw those in the picture. And, you know, so you're used to a 737, which the windows are about this big. You know, you can put your face into it. And a 787, they're about four times the size. These windows are massive. And you get your own window. You're sitting there in this, you know, chair, and you got an iPad in front of you to see some of the stats they want you to see. And then supposedly once you get up where you're waitlist, everybody gets 5 minutes of, you know, unbuckle time. Probably to barf or something. I don't know. But, you float around for a little bit while at the top of the trajectory, and then you know, strap back in and come down. But it was really pretty cool just to see what this thing looked like inside.
What are the materials of the windows?
I was wondering that too, because they've got to be damn strong, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, there's a reason why they made such small windows.
Yeah,
pressurization. Right.
Yeah, because you need the body of the aircraft to be strong enough to not blow apart due to the pressure differential.
If you'll notice, the little windows have little tiny holes in the bottom, because the way airplanes work is they overpressure the cabin and it leaks out. It's a controlled leak from the cabin outward.
Oh. Cool.
I was kind of interested that Bezos was really, they were really pushing like this was a sort of an amusement park ride. They were like, you can come do this. This is amazing. It's not that expensive. I got this sort of Disneyland feel that they're really kind of looking for consumers to come out and like ride the rocket kind of stuff.
Yep. I wouldn't, have they mentioned a price yet?
I don't know. And, you know, Shatner won't say how much he paid. I think Bezos is a big Trekkie. He probably just gave it to him.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the promo.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's worth it.
PR value of that is pretty high.
I believe it's in the six figures, somewhere between 100, maybe 500,000. It's not in the millions. The millions are like going into space.
Okay. So now you know why the second mission is called New Glenn, right?
I do. And, you know, he's got the bottom of the rocket coming back and landing, which looked uber cool. But I guess he's trying to build an orbital rocket. That's the New Glenn, I think.
Yeah, New Glenn is your carnival ride would be three trips around the Earth.
New Glenn because of John Glenn. Okay.
Okay, so I got a number here. So passengers paying $55 million for SpaceX's mission to the ISS get sleeping bags, hygiene products. Blue Origin's trip is going to be $28
million. To the space station. Yeah, the one they took yesterday, this past week, was just up and down. It's not the... And Musk is talking about sending people around the moon. That'd be a hell of a trip.
Yeah. I think it's been published somewhere, but, you know, we're not talking about millions for Bezos' rides. You're talking about hundreds of thousands.
Right, because it's not that long. The rocket's much smaller. There's not that much fuel involved, I don't think.
Yeah, the Inspiration 4 is supposed to be $250,000.
Oh, wow.
Per ticket.
That was 3 days in orbit. That's not bad.
No, that's up and down, isn't it? Inspiration?
No, Inspiration was the one they did with four people around them for 3 days.
Oh. Now, there you go. That's kind of like a weekend in Vegas.
Yeah. Well, not for me, but for a lot of people, I would imagine. Yeah.
Not for me either.
Weekend in Vegas is like $40 for me. $40 in dimes. So radio waves emerge from the direction of the galactic center. And this is really freaking weird. They're picking up radio waves from the galactic center, and it's polarized rotating waves. So if you polarize waves where the waveforms are all in a line, it's not random, and then it's rotating. So, and not only is it polarized and rotating, it's coming and going at random times. It's just a freaking really weird situation, and they're trying to map it up to something that exists, and right now it's not mapping.
I think there's a gigantic set of sunglasses out there, polarized sunglasses rotating. You know, do you ever go in and like look at the ATM machine and you can't see it with your sunglasses on? You got to turn your head sideways.
Yeah,
to read it. Yeah. So that's my theory. I don't know.
Yeah, the has some parallels with another class of mysterious objects known as cosmic burpers.
I was near that guy the other day.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of beer. It's a lot of beer. This is a really, really cool article. These five recent advances are changing everything we thought we knew about electronics. And if you're interested in sort of a recap of the last 10 years, I really enjoyed it. A lot of cool graphics. And I understand now why, like, we're going to see some really, really awesome stuff for the next 5 or 10 years.
And on that article, if you click through on the hardest materials known to man, it's pretty interesting. The click on, you know, graphene being
the hardest
material. It's like they must have forgotten diamonds, but they go and you click on that article, they tell you all about diamonds, only number 7 now. You know, so
well, you know, diamonds are just carbon, and you can't be, I guess, more pure than one atom layer of carbon, which is graphene.
Yeah, why would one atom layer be harder than, you know, a block of it? That's just, you know, doesn't fit between the ears very easily, but they claim it is. So
it is kind of weird.
I believe it's the alignment that occurs.
Yeah, they do talk about the different crystalline structures, and you know the harder things are tetrahedral or something.
And you know that they realized in the last year or two that if they take two sheets of graphene and rotate one about like 10 or 15 degrees, it becomes like a conductor. And they're like, why the hell is that true? And that's become a thing now as well.
Does it become a polarizing lens? Because maybe that's what's between us in that radiation source at the center of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. I see what you're doing, Dan.
So this next article is do not use AWS cloud formation. Any of you guys do a lot of cloud architecture? I mean, like the under the hood kind of stuff.
I've done a good
cloud servers.
So the go-to place for a long time has been AWS. Cloud formation is the way you can use YAML to declare your cloud. All your servers, your resources, how they talk to one another. It's a big, big honking declarative file. You run it, and AWS sets up your resources, and it should start working. And then if you want to get rid of it, you shut down the formation, and it releases all your resources. You don't have to remember all your servers are. It's very nice.
Well, but this is just, it's yet another provision infrastructure as code.
Yes, and that is the problem. His problem is we're coupling into this indirection at AWS, and then you got to go to them, and then they do their own thing, and then if you have to change anything in that string, it's just a mess.
Well, and if you compare it to something like Terraform.
Right. And this, yeah.
Where Terraform, you know, if you're moving from one cloud vendor to another cloud vendor, there's still going to be a bunch of work that you have to do, but a lot of the stuff will still work.
So Terraform's a standard, then?
Yeah, I was very. Terraform is an application that sits on top of all the clouds. So you just code to the Terraform and let them worry about the rest of the stuff.
Yeah. And I should be a little bit more.
A little bit more. Drop the audio. Where are we at here? So we're waiting for them to come back. While we're waiting on that, I've been wanting you guys back yet? No, I've been wanting to use Terraform for some time. But I haven't used it, and I was very sad because I wanted to disagree with this guy, but it turned out he was right. That made me sad. And now I still have a question.
Some AWS servers and getting it all configured right is kind of a nuisance. But
if you're going to use AWS, CloudFormation's the way to go because it atomizes all your resource allocation. But I was really sad because I wanted to disagree with this guy, and I finished the article going, yeah, he's probably right. Terraform's the way to go.
Well, the thing I always liked about Terraform when we were using it was that you're basically just dealing with text files and command line apps, and you're done.
Yep. Repeatable.
I'm interested in what the Lambda serverless story is for Terraform. I haven't looked into that much. If they can do Lambda, I mean.
I am willing to bet that they have brought that in. Yeah. But it's been some time since I've been using Terraform, so.
Because yeah, I have one EC2 provision for a website, something to kick around with, but I won't do servers anymore. It's all get rid of that crap. Just run functions in the cloud.
Well, there is one thing you have to be very careful with things like Terraform, where you come in and you do like a Terraform up, and you just brought on 1,700 servers.
Whoopsie.
It'd be expensive.
Yeah. For all those who are getting or new to the cloud, I was kind of afraid for a while. Set your alarms. Every service has a way to set alarm. Like if you go over $25 or $100, it bing, bing, bing. And you can set the alarm to shut it down too. Absolutely. First thing you do, set your alarms.
Well, and to be fair, it's so easy to do in cloud environments where you thought you brought up 4 instances of this, but you accidentally brought up 400 instances of this.
Or your scaling's off, and so you're scaling up 10 times faster than you need to.
Elbowed on the wrong key, or what?
somebody I was talking to said they got into a loop, and they were calling Lambda functions that were in a circle, and it just blew up. Who was that? But yeah, they said that maybe it was John. He said, but the thing was is that AWS themselves shut it down because it was just burning up too much time.
You have to wonder, in terms of ending up with things like circular dependencies, how convoluted you need to make them before they don't realize that you're doing it.
Well, I wonder if they have their own internal, like a credit limit for each customer. Like, okay, this guy's like Vegas. You know, it's too much fun. Sorry.
Yeah, pull the plug.
Can't cover anymore. This next one is why chaos and complex systems absolutely deserves 2021's Nobel Prize in Physics. And I have to admit to you guys, I saved this because of the cool animated graphics. That's just really cool. There's a little circling atom. And then we got this thing. I don't know what to say with this thing. We're waiting for you guys to come back. This is when you have a bunch of things circling, and it appears to be giving you a wave. And that's actually the way the Milky Way works, it's a complex set of stuff that actually...
Yeah, well, you know.
Oh, wait, here he goes.
I'm back again.
He's done playing Mr. Roboto.
Back again for the very first time. So yeah, I got this for the cool graphics, but it is a really good story as well.
That is a cool graphic.
Isn't that a cool graphic?
Yeah.
It kind of this is the way the Milky Way works. We have a complex system of stars and dust, and looking at it all together, you end up with these spiral arms, and they're just pressure waves. They're not actually stars moving. What else we got? Some of this.
And then there was a pachinko game, wasn't it?
Yes, he does. He does the where you drop the thing down, hit the pegs.
Yeah.
To summarize this article, what really kind of got to the end of was there exist clusters of predictable data inside of complex systems, sort of like a strange attractor would be a line. This is more of a sort of a 2 or 3 dimensional cluster. Cool stuff.
I think we talked about the systems Bible before, didn't we?
That's Galt, isn't it?
Say again? John Galt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like this was like a serious person talking about systems, you know, where John Galt's kind of half tongue in cheek most of the time. And so that was interesting.
Galt comes at this from a sort of a mechanics tool belt kind of spot, which is approachable for us. And this is more of a mathematics physics kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I hate to say this, but I still go back to Elon Musk with his new kind of science book, because a lot of this complex stuff boils down to little pieces of reproducible code just running at scale.
Yeah, that was one of the things, one of the points in there is that complex behavior comes from a group of things with simple behavior, and there's something happening, at the next layer.
One of the best examples of this would actually be neural networks. Neural network, I mean, the general function associated to a node is basically a sigma of its inputs and whether or not it's greater than its threshold.
I finished the first section of my book, which the book's about learning at scale. And so the first section's foundation, and I get to the point where, okay, what we're talking about here, let's just call them probability webs. And then we'll get to the section on neural nets and all that. We'll dive in further. And there's, like you said, there's math and all that stuff. I felt bad about calling it that, but if you start giving any sort of further name, you're like, oh, no, it's not that. It's actually a Markov thing. No, it's actually, a layered ML or whatever. So I just call them probability webs.
What's always made me laugh is that if you actually go through and implement a neural network, a forward feed neural network, you will use nothing inside of that that you did not learn by third grade.
Yes.
Literally, there is nothing in it that you did not learn from math before third grade.
So that was kind of the purpose of that chapter. When you're coding something, right? You finish coding, you go home, you come back, your code is still there. The code is static, right? You make this thing, it's there, it doesn't change. When you're doing a neural net, it's constantly adapting as more data comes in, and you come back the next day, it's a different neural net than it was. And the little code's like a little tiny bit. That's sort of a trivial part of the thing, in a way.
What I've always found funny is that neural networks are seemingly much more complex, but genetic algorithms actually have vastly more math associated with them.
Yes. Well, you get the mutation factor. That's a little tweak you got to do. And you've got how fast should things mutate? How fast should they evolve?
Well, and then you have things like allele identification.
Yes.
Which suddenly we're into like some pretty serious math here.
Yeah, I haven't really considered the learning from genetic.
Not my world.
That's an interesting because, the way genetic programming works is that it's all survival or it's all reproduction based. So if you can reproduce, even if you die the second after, you're good.
Well, and then you've got your mutation factors.
You see the video of the guy who does the bicycles, a guy riding a bicycle. It's all done through genetic programming. He's riding up a mountain, and they build different bicycles based on the program to see how far he can make it, and eventually it gets to the top of the mountain. Cool stuff.
Is it a battery-backed up bicycle?
That's a cool stick, man. Not an e-bike. That was, yeah, $8,000 e-bikes. So somebody on Twitter linked to this the other day. I captured it and dove down a little bit. This guy's talking about optimizing something called R-Lanes. So he has some cool things about optimization. And then I was like, what the hell is R-Lanes? And R-Lanes is a Microsoft research project to take .NET into a asynchronous cloud deployment system.
And we essentially an actor model.
They have an actor model. We have been down this road many, many times. And I got to the point where they said, we're going to strongly type the stuff. And I'm like, okay, we're done. They've got little grains. They've made up their own word, grains, which is really, I like the idea of grains. They have to go with an actor model. But once they start going typing across servers and business users, then you've got the stuff we talked about before, versioning issues. You've got stuff that hangs out for 3 days and comes back and you've changed the version. It's going to be a mess. Type the stuff when you need it, but not just send it in there. That was the problem with the PowerShell. PowerShell, I don't know if you've used it. I've used it a slight bit, but it was just, oh my God. Like, you want to do directory. It was like directory dot, you know, enumerator dot. It was just this big object-oriented scripting thing. It was like, fuck.
But what I'm kind of curious about is where they're really going to head with it, because you could take a look at Okka Cloud as an example. And that might be an interesting direction for them to go if they were doing it in a similar way.
I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the idea of having a universal type around all of your possible applications, no matter what that type is just a freaking mess. Now, you can say, I'm going to have this particular type in a message queue, and I'm going to get it off the end, and you've narrowed your problem down to this one type. But like I've 50 types and 12 teams, it's a mess. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, if I'm sticking stuff in the envelope and you're getting it out, or even if 10 people are getting it out, we're good. Because I'm controlling the type. It's a straight stream. It's one thing. Bob's your uncle. But if we've got this web of 50, 100 types and we got dozens of teams, who the hell knows what you're going to have this super architect, the type police. It's not fun. I got a job.
Take your word for that.
I got a job years ago. These guys were trying to do. They were trying to do MDA. And they hired me because the architect was like, well, these developers are not listening to my, what they should be doing. And he wanted me to lock down the type system so that they could not create types. And I said, no, this is a very bad idea. I can do it, but no, you don't want to do that. So this next one I ran across, and I'm not really sure if I'm impressed, or I don't know, I'm impressed. It's Bolero. And it's using F# and WebAssembly. And the idea is you just write some F# code, and I guess you push the magic button, and it becomes JavaScript, and you runs on a browser, and you have nothing else to do there. Just you're coding right into the browser. This gets the thing we're talking about last week, because what I don't like is this honking, sticking the HTML in the code crap that we're doing all the time now. And I know it looks cool, like, hey, I can control the HTML just from this piece of code. It's like, yes, you can, but it's HTML. I can't see the structure of the fucking HTML anymore. Instead, I'm looking at your code. And that's not what I want to see. I want to see the structure, right? It's a different thing. I don't know. Model view update, pretty cool. Hot reloadings. It sings, it dances, it makes Julian fries. So I'm very impressed with the work they've done. I just have not bought into framework as code for many of the same reasons we're talking about with the AWS thing. This is a really neat thing. I read about half of this. This is an introduction to IPv6 for you folks who know IPv4. I've known this. I played around with it. I read this. And I know I'm going to forget it next week. So when I get back to it, it's going to have to be looking at it again. IPv6 is a very complicated animal. You guys do any networking stuff?
Well, what does that mean?
Well, it used to be your computer had a sort of four-chunk address, 192.67. whatever, right? Yep. Everybody knows that. And you would get your address, either you code it in your computer or get it from a DHCP server. Now you've got 128 byte address. So it's like then blah, 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 blah. So it's a huge thing you're looking at. It's no more just typing little letters in. And because you have so many bytes, they're looking at uniquely identifying every freaking thing that's on the internet. Basically, that's the gimmick here. You just, everything's got a number.
I've got some INET6 stuff here on my Linux box. Ooh. So there's, just asked for my IP config. And so I've got some 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 things between the colons. So there's 8 parts of the address instead of 4.
Yes.
And then they're much bigger numbers too. Is that the deal?
Yes, much bigger numbers. And the subnets instead of, the subnet used to be like we'd give you 24 addresses to use on your home. Now you got another 8 bytes to use for sub. It's just you. It's like you could have an internet device for every atom in the universe.
Yeah. The big problem was, if I remember correctly, IPv4 only goes to 4 billion addresses. And then you've got big swaths of those which have been reserved for varying purposes.
Yeah, and they're running out. They are out. James, try IP-6 address here. You can see the code on your Linux box. It should give you like what you're doing there. It lists so your IP space hyphen 6 space address.
IP-6 address. It's not in my system.
Not dash address, just plain address. Because standards.
IP, say it again now.
IP.
Yep.
Hyphen 6.
Yep.
Just plain address.
And there would be, let's see.
Did you get anything back?
Nope.
Well, can you see the code on the screen?
Oh. I need to hear the spaces too, damn it. Okay. Yes, I got something now.
Woo-hoo. And it should have a numbered list of your adapters. Number one usually is your local host kind of thing. And then the rest of that's all your adapters. And with IPv6, because you got so many damn numbers, one network card can actually have multiple IP addresses. This IP address, I'm going to talk to stuff just in the house. This IP address, I'll talk just to the people in India. It can make it extremely complicated.
Because that's absolutely what we need with computers, is more ways to make them complicated.
Yeah, I think we're on the right track then to keep our jobs alive for a long time.
I was on Hacker News this morning, and they were talking, I think it was an article, Why F-Sharp is Cool or whatever. And one of their commenters said, well, you know, C-Sharp's a really good functional language too. I'm like, fuck. Just poke my eye out with a fork now. It's like, if it does everything, it does nothing. Okay? We're not talking about the features of the language. We're talking about the programmer sitting down trying to solve a problem, and you're giving him a billion choices. It's like, no, stop.
You should have had some good fun with him and said that C is actually your favorite functional programming language.
Oh, yeah. The respondent said that Haskell is actually a great imperative language. And he had a Stack Overflow link and everything. So we were talking about neural networks. I have not gone through this, but this is a little helper thing that's really cool. This girl put together, lady put together like an animated thing. It shows you how to go through the cores and stuff. It looked really cute and neat. When I get back into neural nets, I'm going to use this as a sort of starting point. And I think she's just doing pretty much the graphical part of neural nets. As we both know, there's a whole ton of other stuff that's probably just as interesting or more.
Oh, it's usually more interesting, all the other stuff aside from graphics.
This next article is, I'm a developer. I won't teach my kids to code, and neither should you.
Yeah, because there's no good reason. There's no good reason to not harm a child.
Yes, there's no future in coding. You got to go into claymation. There's a lot of money in claymation. So I clicked on this, wanting to punch the guy in the face because I'm kind of cranky. And I got reading it, and he's not really saying that. He's saying that a lot of people want to compare programming to, like, writing, being literate, reading and writing. And I agree with that, but programming is not being a scribe. You know, we had scribes that spent their entire lives doing little letters, and programming is not using an API or syntax. Programming is understanding sequences and transforms, and you don't even need a computer to learn to program. But his point is that he didn't want to teach them syntax. And I'm like, well, you don't have to.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, the biggest problem that we deal with as an industry is not normally how to write code. It's what code needs to be written.
Right. What problem are we trying to solve?
And I was still kind of frustrated with the guy because, you know, he gets to the end of his essay, he admits that he's really talking about syntax. And he does all this kind of lovey, fluffy crap about being a good parent and kids are nice and teach the kid how to work with fixing things around the house. And it wasn't that it was wrong. It was just it didn't actually address the how do I teach my kid to solve problems thing. It's more like how to be a good dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a line here. There are no books that teach you how to solve problems. Right. That's probably not true.
Did I mention before that I started writing a book for children about programming?
Oh, my God. No. How far did you get?
So I'm a couple chapters in right now, and basically what the book is we're going to start with a computer that has nothing on it, and we're going to make it work.
Sounds like a throwback to a different year.
Yeah. Well, that's when the guy's talking. This guy actually wrote a book on simplifying JavaScript. But when you think about programming, I don't think about JavaScript. I think about basic, like print hello.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder how many from our generation actually started on basic.
The thing is that we're starting people programming in JavaScript, and it's not the thing. Yeah, James.
No, I've started in basic. I was just thinking, is that the first? Yeah. That would have been the first language.
We're starting them in this one of these polyglot languages like C#, where there's so many things it does, and there's just like complicated deployment build thing. You just need like do A, do B, do C. That's just as simple as that, and you can go from there. But you've got to like have a very simple place to start.
Have you ever tried Scratch?
No.
From MIT, Scratch.
Is it a teaching language?
Yeah, it's for kids, and it's graphical, and you basically have little things that you can drop in. And a friend of mine asked me to do a, you know, career day for the fifth graders. It's like, oh, shoot, what am I going to do for fifth graders? I'm used to talking to, you know, adults that already know how to program. What I'll do with fifth graders? And so I came across through a recommendation from a friend, this Scratch thing. And in 20 minutes that I had, by asking them the right questions, we built a game, which is cat chasing a laser, right? Oh, cool. You know, so we can make a little laser pointer, and it's like, okay, now that we have a laser pointer, what should we do? It's like, oh, you know, what do cats do if they see a laser? Oh, they pounce on it. And so basically a series of about 15 leading questions, and we had built a game to have a cat chase a laser around.
You know, that kind of translation from I understand this natively and I put it in the code, that's coding. Language shouldn't matter. You should be able to like write a list of how you want the game to work, talk about it with everybody, and then you talk about how that list has to change to become more formal when you put it in this thing over here. Right? And you probably did it the better way by taking them a step at a time. But what you're doing there is they're implicitly kind of converting what they're saying into whatever this thing wants.
Yeah.
But that's coding.
A couple of them were mad at me because I said, do you like puzzles? And then right away they said yes, and then they realized they were being tricked into doing something. They didn't know, but no.
Dang it! Yeah, I was in the Marines, and somebody said, "Hey, you guys interested in doing some police work?" I'm like, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. Policing means cleaning up stuff. So okay, we need this whole place policed. Like, thanks.
You wanted to go catch bad guys?
Yeah, I was like, hey, you'll get like a badge. Friend of mine was in the Navy. He went through basic training, and they had happy hour. And so if you did something wrong, you had this little chit you gave the guy because you did something wrong. And then you got to go to happy hour. In happy hour, he said, we went to this big auditorium. They gave us this really heavy chain that had it run around in a circle holding this chain. And the guy said, you guys happy yet? And somebody said, "No, heck no, this is awful. Well, keep going. We've got time." Greg, you still with us?
Greg's checking his gun safe up there. I don't know.
This next
article, camera's picking up. I don't know.
Yeah, Greg does the moving around stuff. I'm never really sure where he's going to go or like.
I was wondering how long his cord was on that headset, but I guess he's bringing his computer with him. So,
yeah, it's much easier that way.
Next one, Y Combinator CEO. He says, if you're not drowning in demand, you don't have to the market fit. This is something I need to remind myself over and over again. We build programs to make solve problems for people. If you're doing a good job, they're going to want us to do more. They're going to pull that out of more coding out of us. You don't want to be programming in a situation where you're forcing somebody to use your stuff.
This makes me think of something Uncle Bob used to say in the 90s. He probably still says it, but I thought it was kind of interesting at the time and still like to quote it. He said, if you're not getting a call from somebody about adding a feature to your code, you better find a new business.
Yeah.
Because they're not using it.
Yeah, we talk about, you know, this gets the kid thing we're just talking about. You know, we talk about programming just on one side, like how you write the stuff in the box. But this is what that guy, the essay guy, did. But really, it's that translation between here's what I want. Okay, we can make it do that. Oh, can you make it do blah, blah? Oh, yeah, I can make it do that. It's that sort of back and forth. That's the cool part.
Yep. You'd think that, you know, so I'm my IT department as well as my head customer. You'd think that I know what I want in my website, and then I could just think of that and then do that. It doesn't work that way. I make what I want for myself, and I go, oh, that doesn't work very good. You need something different than that. And so I'm constantly, you know, two hats.
You just, second hat. Like,
oh, James, it should do this. Well, yeah, we can make it do that, but.
It's going to be expensive.
I'm sure you want it? Oh, yeah. You want it now? Oh, no, I need something different.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the dang staff here. Just, they suck. It's,
you know, my IT department is horrible.
I wrote a programming language once and did that, and it was horrible. One of the best things I ever did. And the reason why is I didn't have a spec for the language. Instead, I coded as I went along, and that made me think through all the edge cases as I went along because I had to do that kind of dual hat thing you're doing. Yeah, it was a painful thing.
That wasn't me. That was
the other guy. Yeah, my evil twin, James. Google, YouTube, to prohibit ads and monetization on climate denial content.
Oh, my gosh.
And the problem here is how do you really identify whether somebody is one of those nasty climate denial people? I mean, do they say cloud too much? Are they saying, hey, looks kind of cold outside? I mean, where do you cross the line there?
Right. Yeah, like if you said something about how cold it is in Antarctica, you know, coldest ever recorded, you know, that would probably be a climate denial aspect, wouldn't it?
Yes, if you said the temperature, average temperature of the Earth changing over time is not as much as we predicted, that would probably be fine. But if you said the word, you know, I guess, I don't know, warmest or something, no. You've got to pass the algorithm first.
And this algorithm is going to be a neural net that's going to learn to find, you know, people that deny the climate change, or maybe the proposed solutions to climate change, people that want different solutions, they'll probably be banned too, right?
Yes, exactly. Because
almost certainly.
Yeah, in many cases, the way you decided that,
okay, climate change is real, but what should we do about it? Right. If you disagree with what Google thinks, you probably will be banned too, right?
Well, many times the toughest problems we have are because we've described them in ways that don't have easy solutions. And to fix them, you have to back up and re-describe the problem. But you can't do that here because AI going to come get you.
Yeah.
And what really pisses me off about this is what they're going to do. They're not going to take your video. They're going to take the ads off your video and then pitch other videos to your readers while they're there that they're going to put their own ads. They'll continue to make a bunch of money. It's just you're going to get screwed because you said the wrong word the AI keyed off of.
So, Dan, keep your stuff off of YouTube. Keep it on...
Yeah, Vimeo is what I'm using right now. So I related to this is that there was a leak this past week of thing. George Carlin had, what was it, 7 things you can't say on TV. This is the 100 pages of stuff you can't say on Facebook. No shit.
Let me go check to see how many of them said this week.
100 pages. It's a terror page. You can't use the Hitler word. Hitler is a very bad thing. They can't use his word or name. I don't even know where to go with
which
this.
Which link is this?
It would be the second link on that page there.
From the bottom?
Yeah, it's row 16.
Row 16, okay.
And column E.
Oh, you got 2 links on one.
Yeah, I added a deeper dive column because.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so
it's like not telling people about the Doomsday Machine.
Well, I wanted to really talk about the fun articles, but when I went over this stuff, everything had more depth, and I felt like I was cheating people not to have some kind of follow-up link.
Gotcha.
What's kind of hilarious with this trying to formalize all the things that you cannot discuss. So what if I
and we're gone for a minute. I'll be coming back. I noticed that the Goodwill Charitable Organization is an Islamic, is a terror organization.
I haven't really talked about OTIC Aviation, though. I'm wondering what's wrong with that.
Goodwill Charitable Organization. They do a lot of terror. Yeah, you drop your old clothes off there, you don't know where they're going to end up at. where do they get the golden fish, Liberia? There's more bad words about terror on here than there are actual terrorists, probably.
Dangerous individuals.
Oh, dangerous individuals. I have that. What page are you on?
Dan, you're on the top of the list.
They've got my picture there, which is kind of nice. It's a good shot of me.
Nerd Roundup is mentioned. Oh, my God.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm with the other guys. Maqua Games. It's just
I love is that as you're scrolling through that, it's just pages and pages and pages of these things. But a user is expected that they should understand what all of those things are.
And there's mostly no appeal. If they take your stuff, there's nobody to talk to. You're just done.
Yeah, sure.
Dangerous individuals. Here we go. Dangerous individuals. Ooh. Yeah, wow. United States, the Latin Kings. Sounds sort of like a jazz band.
So what was it?
Oh, there's actually quite a bit about Latin Kings up here.
20 page 26 of Latin Kings. They're a gang. Crying, yeah.
Yeah, they're a gang.
I wonder if they also play music on the weekends. Or probably not.
No.
Yeah, so you're right, Greg. You're supposed to know 100 pages of words. This is like domain squatting. Like some idiot uses this phrase, says, I'm the whoever, and now everybody in the universe has to know not to use that phrase. Yeah.
There you go. Well.
Yeah, this is, and you would, some of this, A Voice for Men. Very bad. Very bad bunch. They're a hate group. Yeah, I don't even know where to go with this. This is I'm not going to memorize this. George Carlin was much better. We only had 7 words we couldn't say.
Yeah.
Well, but what's interesting with that document, and that document's going to continue expanding.
Oh my God! Yeah, sure.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Where is it going to be a decade from now? It's like, didn't you look this up in this 700-page book of things that you're told that you cannot say?
And there is an interlocking relationship these companies have with various charities and non-governmental organizations. Somebody said the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified 18 out of the last 3 hate groups to come. because they just have an incentive to call everybody hate because it drives donors.
Yep.
I found the name of a guy I used to work with in here. I'm sure it's not him. But
I hope
not an uncommon name.
That was scary. It was a scary list. 100 pages. Wow. This is a very interesting article. Are you guys interested in doing a deep dive on what's wrong with social media from a startup business standpoint? This guy's got it. The thesis, as I understand it, is social media builds graphs based on who you know and then tries to monetize these content threads. It should be building graphs around what you'd like to talk about. And then you wouldn't argue so much.
It's reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe somebody could make a website about what we agree on.
I don't think there would be anybody there. It would be an empty website.
Then again, there have been forums doing this for many years where they have forum per discussion topic. And I do not see less hate going back and forth on those than most than what you would see on Facebook.
Yeah, like, you want the curly braces aligned? Oh.
It's tabs versus spaces. Pick your side.
Yeah, white space after the periods and semicolons? Come on.
So, related to that, there was an article, or is this?
Okay, I guess we're just a disagreeable bunch, aren't we,
Greg? Well, they had an article this morning about, what was it? One of the admins of Hacker News was talking about kind of what they wanted to see posted and what they didn't want to see posted. And he was like, you know, I just want to see interesting conversations. And, you know, if you're flaming somebody, that's not interesting.
Well, even some of the flaming posts can be interesting. Like, it's entirely possible to write a highly educated but yet flaming post.
Yes, and those are some. That's the best kind of troll. Yeah.
Now, flaming would mean you're taking somebody down or you're going against someone's opinion or whatever.
Oh, flaming is going to be more that you are, I guess we could say, openly aggressive. You're taking down the person, but you're also taking down their entire argument at the same time.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Which you see quite a bit.
Yeah, bonus points. And this, I do this when I get really cranky. Bonus points when you understand their weakest point of their argument and you understand their comeback and you just destroy both of them at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then they're just kind of left with a handful of nothing. That's not fun. I'm not proud of myself doing that, but do get angry.
I was interacting with someone several years ago, and they were convincing me of their position. And it has once it was like, okay, I kind of get it. And then the last statement they said, and that's why such and such a group are all derogatory.
Yeah, losers, but yeah, you say,
yeah, whatever it was.
Yeah, like snowmen are fine. Okay, I like bunnies. And those guys are a bunch of assholes.
Yeah, well, that was it, yeah.
What did you do? You'd like say, you know, everything but that last sentence sounds pretty good.
I just stopped interacting with the person.
Yeah.
Well, I decided, you know, it's not a respectful relationship, and so I don't need to participate in it. I'm not that vested.
My favorite has always been the people that are so clueless that they don't know that they're clueless.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what they
do. So, like, I've had someone come on flaming me over me having corrected them about something with CQRS, and them literally coming back with, well, what in the hell would you know about CQRS? And it's like, well, I kind of named it. I might know a thing or two about it.
I used to work for Ivar Jakobsen.
What's PQRS?
CQRS, it's Command Query Response Subject Query. I used to work for Ivar Jakobsen, the guy who did user stories. And I'd have people go, well, why do you know anything about user stories? I'm like, book? This is my boss. Okay. So this was a good discussion, and Dang, who's the moderator, talked about just wanting to have good conversations and trying to moderate for that. And they're doing a pretty good job, I guess. But, you know, even then, once it gets to be a large crowd, it just gets kind of mediocre. If you do a good job of moderating, it just, meh.
Well, moderation is one of those things that's just hard to do.
Yeah. I agree.
So the most successful moderations I've seen have actually been where you just allow the group to moderate itself.
Yes.
Well, so we can do this very simply. As an example, you have an upvote, downvote, mm-hmm. and you have a threshold where, like, you see things above a certain upvote level.
I think what happens is you get these gangs. That works well until you get these circles of people coming by who want to, like, shut down other people, and that gets to be a problem.
Well, no, but you still allow other people to see the things that were downvoted. It's they opt into them.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that, but my point being is the larger the crowd, the more it just sort of gets to be blah. Because people are going to downvote any, it's like a herd of cows. People are going to downvote anything that's too far out of the norm, the herd.
So on one site that I deal with, it's absolutely hilarious to watch. You have, in the politics sections, the admins are all essentially with one political party.
Oh, and you can't tell either, can you?
All you have to do is go look at all the stuff that's taken down, yes. And you're like, everything is all on one side of the aisle.
So yep. I joined Matrix. I got the Element. There's a chat program. It's all cryptographically secure and blah, 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 anonymous. I joined about a year and a half ago. And a year, 12, 14 months ago, I opened up the Intellectual Dark Web Open Room. And then I just turned it off, went away for a year. I came back. I got like 200 people there, and they somehow are working it out. Our last story, there were two men were stuck at sea for 29 days, lost. And their comment was, it was a kind of a nice break from everything. They still probably got calls about their car warranty, but other than that, they're probably okay.
Hi, we're calling you about your car warranty. Yes, my current GPS positions are...
Oh, my God. Yeah, help me. Yeah, Amazon does a drone delivery to their raft. Okay, guys, let me wrap this thing up. So, you've wasted yet another hour on Nerd Roundup. We're happy to have you. Please drop by again, and I will see you on the internet.